Hey, everybody, listen up. I got mega huge news. Meat Eater Live is heading back out on the road. That's right. Join me and the crew. Clay Newcomb, Cal, Yanni, Spencer's going to be there. Phil the Engineer is going to be there. Meat Eater Live, headed back out. Now, when you get every ticket, okay, every ticket you buy, you get a signed copy of our new Meat Eater Outdoor Cookbook. This tour is celebrating the release of the book. Buy a ticket, get a signed copy, Meat Eater Outdoor Cookbook, wild game recipes for the grill, smoker, camp stove, and campfire, which I'll point out is a $38 value. Here's where we're going to go. April 23rd, the Mesa Arts Center in Mesa, Arizona. April 24th, the Balboa Theater in San Diego. April 25th, the Grove in Anaheim, California. April 27th, the Crest Theater in Sacramento. April 29, the Union in Salt Lake City. April 30, the Egyptian in Boise. May 1, the Wilma Theater in Missoula. May 2, the Bing Crosby Theater in Spokane, Washington. May 4, Revolution Hall in Portland, Oregon. And May 5, the last day of the tour, Pantages Theater in Tacoma, Washington. For tickets and more information, visit the events page at TheMeatEater.com. Hope to see you at the show.
Hey, I'm Tyler.
And I'm KC.
And you're listening to
The Element Podcast.
Okay, guys, today we are doing a Q&A session. We just kind of came up with this last second. I'm in Austin, Texas right now, and KC is actually back home. What's weird is it's usually sunshiny in Austin, but it's raining, and it's been raining at home like crazy, but it's sunshiny there, I believe, right?
That is correct. It's a nice day outside, kind of bordering on hot. You can definitely feel that summer pushing in. Yep. It's weird how spring is so short where we live, but the vegetables are liking it, so that's all. It's that's what matters right now.
It's good, man.
Antlers are growing.
Yeah, antlers are growing. Tomatoes are growing. It's all good, man. I think, you know, I'm down here right now. Actually, my wife is a coach here at our local school, and the girls are in the state softball tournament. They're actually playing in the state game, which has been postponed. So you and I are doing this, but the rain has postponed the game. But they have made it to the state game. So we're rooting for them. Hopefully tonight that'll happen. But
let's go, Lady Cat.
That's right. In the meantime, last night I went and spent all of my money at Dai Due because it was so good. It was literally one of the best meals I've ever had. You know, we had Jesse Griffiths on the podcast last week, I believe it was. And we're down here in Austin for the state tournament. We're like, oh yeah, we're going. So I took a couple of friends of ours and our kids and everything, and went to Dai Due. And Jesse had just come back from Port O'Connor and was able to scrounge up enough blue crabs that he fried us up a soft shell or two and gave us this. I mean, the dish was incredible, dude. It had this, like, roumelade, or however you say that, roumelade sauce. Yeah. Like these mint leaves on it, which you wouldn't think would go good with fried soft shell, but it was like heaven, dude. It was so good. We had Neil
it
Guy.
Sounds real good.
We had, the people that were with us had a Wagyu steak. We had, I actually had Black Drum for the first time. It was just great, you know. I mean,
as far as you know, actually.
Well, that's true. Who knows what this is?
A lot of times when you eat seafood at the especially in Texas, a lot of times it's Black Drum because they do so well with aquaculture.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yep. So, yeah, that was first time I know of that I had Black Drum, right?
Yep.
So, but
a fresh one.
It was, right? Oh, it was so good, dude. And, like, you know, obviously everything that Jesse does, he's tested it several times to the point that it's just amazing, you know, and they've got it down, and it was crazy good.
That means Jesse eats it himself.
Exactly. Yes. Well, so I just actually saw where he posted on Instagram just a second or just a little bit ago that it's this mound of blue crabs that he had boiled up, I guess, for his dinner tonight. So I was like, dang, man.
Nice.
He literally gave me one of his soft shells, you know, like this wasn't something they were going to put in the shop, you know, so. pretty cool deal, man.
That's cool.
Super appreciative of what he did for us, man. And big time, awesome surprise. The people we were with enjoyed it. Just, I mean, they loved it. So really cool. But now we are trying to burn through these Q&A question or these questions with some of our answers, I guess. And we thought it would be a good idea just to, since we're kind of apart, to do this kind of format and threw it together today. And a bunch of people had questions, so we're going to start throwing them out there and answering them, I guess, unless you have something you wanted to talk about.
No, man, that sounds great. I would rather just do this Q&A stuff as opposed to talk about me.
Good, man, because there's some there's some really good questions, man, that I've said several times to you already. I'm excited to answer. So with that, I'm gonna go through some on my end. You've got some on your end. We'll both try to answer if we both have an answer, and if we don't, we'll move on. We're going to try to get through these all. Everyone that we've seen, and if you have more, we'll try to throw some of those into the next episode maybe or something like that at some point. So thank you for these. I guess the first one I kind of want to talk about here is from Luke MCD44 on Instagram. He said, first time in the hill country, how do you figure, and these are kind of paraphrased, guys, and I'm kind of, you know, trying to formulate the questions and maybe take what you're saying and make it into a question sometimes. But I asked kind of what are the most confusing things about deer hunting or some of the things that you'd like us to answer questions about. And who knows if we're going to help or not. We're going to try. So Luke says, first time into the hill country, how do you figure wind strategy? You got any thoughts about that, Casey?
I'm assuming he's talking about kind of the Midwestern mm-hmm. type hill country.
I would too.
But it probably applies to both. You know, because Texas has a region called the Hill Country, which you're in right now. You're on mm-hmm. the eastern border of it, where it starts. But it's going to kind of be the same. You know, it's going to have ridges and fingers and all that stuff. In general, I think I'm going to talk about thermals a little bit, and then you actually have more experience hunting hill country than I do, so I think you'll be a better answer. But this is something that hunting elk really helped me with, because it's the same concept. You just need to keep in mind that on still or, you know, not heavy wind days where you have, you know, maybe an aggressive northwestern wind or something, that in the mornings it will rise and in the evening it will fall once the sun starts to get low. So it's just the natural cycle of heating and cooling, where when things heat up, they rise, and whenever they cool down, they go down. So you just need to make sure and position yourself according to where you think deer are or are going to be, or where your shots are going to be, and according with that daily cycle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. That's kind of the main thing to keep in mind, I think, like you said. And I think that for me, there are guys that are way more experienced in hunting the hill country than we are, or hill-type country. And so, I mean, probably getting some information from those guys is good. Now, not everybody out there actually knows what they're talking about, but you know, if there's several people saying the same thing that are reliable and have killed deer in that type of habitat, then you could probably take it to the bank. But I would say like I hunted a big ridge in Iowa in 2019 actually, and had a deer come all the way to 5 yards that I was trying to shoot, had camera issues. You can watch that video on our season playlist. It's actually, I think, the video before I killed a deer in Iowa. So if you go back and you see that video, the one I shot last year, then you can look at the one before that. And that deer was on a big ridge. And so, like, kind of the advice that I got that seemed a lot more practical and easy was just to get on top of the ridge, because deer, you know, they talk about these, like, you know, bedding on the top third, traveling the top third, and I'm sure it happens. But even on some pretty decent sized ridges, like, you know, you can call deer up to you or get shot still to some of that downridge stuff, you know, like if you're above them. So I think, like, being kind of on the top of the ridge, a lot of times you can just let the wind just blow, you know, straight from whatever side. You know, I was kind of on the side where I'm blowing, like, I'm basically on top, but I'm kind of on the wind, the side that the wind is coming from. So just letting it blow, mm-hmm. you know, kind of just, it gives you a good stable wind if you've got a wind a lot of times. And people talk about wind tunnels and stuff like this, and I would say just to try to figure out what you can, and obviously carry some milkweed with you and test it when you get in there, and that'll help you a lot probably. Mm-hmm. So anything else to add to that, or you want to move on?
I would just that I'm not trying to be nitpicky or anything, but something I have noticed is that if you have like a, say you're hunting down in the bottom or you're hunting on the side of a ridge right up top, and you have a wind that is flowing parallel or down your ridge or valley, okay? Mm-hmm. And that wind, whenever the ridge or valley is going to take a slight turn, will actually follow that turn. So keep that in mind as well. If you're banking on northeast wind and your valley runs north and south, then you're probably still going to have a straight north and south.
Okay.
In that particular place. That's the only other thing that comes to mind. It's kind of a, it's a friction type thing with the way that, you know, wind currents move or whatever, but it's just a little thought. Pretty much just check the milkweed, like you said, and then you're in good shape.
Yeah. Yeah. If you can throw several milkweeds out and they all go to do the same thing, you know, you can bank on that. But another thing to think about real quick, I hate to keep going on this because we've got a ton of questions, but if you're hunting at evening, you're likely to see that the wind dies in the, during the best time of the evening, so when the deer are going to be moving the most probably. So just keep in mind that your thermals also have to work for you in that situation. So anyway.
Well, I got a shorter one for you. Tyler, what release do you shoot?
I've shot a Cobra for like 15 years. I shoot the dual caliper. I'm not saying I wouldn't shoot the other one, because I think what you do with yours is makes a lot of sense. Like, it's so just practical and logical. But yeah, I mean, that's what I shoot is a Cobra, and I like their ownership with Jake Major. He's been on the podcast before. Super good dude. High energy. Engineering type, just really digs into this stuff. And like I said, I shot one single release for like a dozen years and had no issues.
Did. It rusted and everything. You still work like a champ.
Yeah.
I shoot Cobra as well. It's the hook style. I think it's called the Moment. I can't really remember for sure. But it's a hook. It's like kind of like a rhino horn or a turkey spur.
There you go.
It just makes it where you don't have to look down at your D-leaf all the time.
Yep. So
real nice.
Yep.
What else you got?
What about entry and exit access? Like, what are the things you consider when you're looking at your accesses and your exit?
Man, wind is the top thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if I'm looking at something, like, I've been scouting for South Dakota on the map, right? And the first thing I do when I look at a whole property is I think about, well, where's the habitat that I'm trying to hunt? And then the next thing is, what is the wind going to do and how am I going to get in there? And everything else, I truly feel like there's wind and everything else when it comes to access. But wind is the top thing you got to keep in mind. You cannot blow your wind on deer for an extended period of time and expect them to do what they were normally going to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, I mean, pretty much nailed it. Like, you gotta, your wind has to line up for you to be able to access without the deer knowing you're accessing, and then also hunt it for an hour and a half before a deer comes out to you or whatever. So yeah, that's the main things. I mean, obviously there's, you know, you got to make sure that there's not a big creek or something or a river that you got to cross. So you got to make sure, like, kind of when you look into access, don't just go, oh yeah, the wind's got to be this. Make sure you kind of like look at your route in detail to make sure you don't have to pass an irrigation. Like, I've looked at a lot of stuff that all of a sudden I'll notice there's an irrigation canal. I'm like, golly, that was going to be perfect, but I can't get through that irrigation canal, I don't think, if it's, especially if it's been raining. So
yeah, exactly. Another thing that I think that you and I have been trying to learn the past few years that we used to be real sloppy about is exits at nighttime.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so we're going in for an evening hunt. I have been real guilty of, like, as soon as I climb down the stand, just not caring about stealth at all and just rolling out. Well, that's a real good way to blow out a place in just a day or two, you know. But I think if you're careful about your exits and you're stealthy, even in the dark, trying to get out of a place, as well as, you know, the common sense thing whenever it's daylight and you're going in, I think that you can really preserve a place for a little more time, at least if it's a situation where you're, you know, hunting some specific deer that are living in the area.
Yeah. I used to be way better about that when I hunted private a lot, because I was like, you know, you get down, you're like, man, I know there's like $3 in here that are just giants, and like, I've got to get out of here quick. Plus, you're not tearing down every time, you know? And so you just kind of, sometimes you like, you go in and you hunt public and it's a bad day and you didn't see anything. And you feel like, man, there ain't a deer within a mile of me right now, you know? And so you just take your time breaking down. You're kind of loud. You talk a little bit to your buddy or whatever it might be. You're not careful with the sticks. And who knows, man? Like, maybe that's the reason you're having bad hunts back to back to back, you know?
So, oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, we've seen places wear out quickly, you know, especially on Texas public when you're hunting an area where there's might not be a ton of deer and they're pretty concentrated on a specific habitat or food source. Mm-hmm. You know, it's definitely a thing that happens.
Yeah.
I think that whenever you're talking about access stuff, you probably need to talk about creative access a little bit. I know it's kind of a twist to the question. But that's something you and I have been talking about quite a bit for some of our October hunts that we have coming up, about making sure that we have everything it takes to get into a place or maybe do something creative that other people don't do, whether it's, you know, waders or boats or things like that. And I think that that's definitely a tactic that's out there. It's not, if you're like, oh, wow, I've never thought about using a boat, you know, you probably just haven't listened to a lot of podcasts, but it's still something to be said, you know, like there's people who have success doing it. I think you and I are going to do it probably far and near this fall. We've talked about it in a couple of different places. You know, there's a place that we scouted out that looks bad at the bone on Texas public this year that we walked in. But I know that you're busting through some habitat to walk in. Mm-hmm. But if you happen to figure out a way to use some type of aquatic access to this place, then, man, it's going to be Stealth City, Texas up in there.
You're talking about like a straw and a wetsuit?
Yeah, I think something like that. You ever watched Robin Hood with him and Little John and them little pieces of bamboo they were breathing
yes,
through?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm thinking.
Yeah, yeah.
So, hey, your buddy Dudley Phelps wants to know why he prefers punishing himself on public versus private.
Man, Dudley, some people are just into weird stuff, man. I can't tell you.
Oh, that was a question he posed.
It gets addicting. I mean, you know, You don't want to be a public land snob, but at the same time, there's a fun aspect to it for sure.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, there's good aspects to both of them. I think, just kind of giving yourself a new change of scene is a reason why you would punish yourself sometimes, you know? It's just like, man, try to get a look at a new piece of woods, you know? You can't really do that on private because there's only so much access to be had, you know, sometimes.
Yeah, and to make that more tactical. New experiences means new knowledge learned, you know, and if you and I talk about this all the time, but, you know, once you're red pill and don't like sitting in a box, the same box blind day in and day out, waiting on a deer to come out, like that's hard to do once you realize you can go out and, you know, make your own way and make things happen yourself like you can on public land. And sometimes you can't make things happen yourself, and that's part of it too, right?
Yeah.
But, I think that's part of the deal is, and some guys, I'm not this guy at all. I wish there was no one else out there except for me. But don't take it the wrong way. I'm not saying I wish there were less hunters, but you know, as far as like in scenario situation, I don't get any kicks or giggles out of the competition with other people in the woods. You know what I mean? That's not me at all. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. But I don't care about that. But some people like that aspect of going out in doing the deal where anybody could hunt this land, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's cool that you can make it, if you can make it happen in that situation and think about that, that's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the way I am too, man. I would prefer, not that I want less hunters in the woods, same thing, but like, I would prefer that when I go into the woods, sometimes I feel like I'm the only guy within 15 miles, you know, it's like,
oh, that feels real good.
That's just like, man, that is a good feeling. You're just like, man, this is where big deer live because nobody's around and this is just fun and I don't have to hear 18 wheelers going by and stuff, you know. It's a good feeling.
Yeah.
But
That's cool.
So
do bow brands matter, Tyler?
That's a big question, but I mean I know what you're trying to get to, and I would say not too much, man. Like these days, the new bows that are coming out are getting better in smaller increments than they ever have. So I think that, everybody's starting to, not everybody, but most, you know, if you know of a pretty reputable brand that people will talk about and like and has sold, you know, thousands of bows. They probably are making a bow that you can kill a deer with pretty well, as well as the other ones, just about within 30 yards or so. You know what I mean? I think you mentioned that earlier when we were talking about this, but I think there are a couple of companies that are trying to innovate a little bit and do some different things, help the consumer to do a little more of their bow teching and stuff like that. But, you know, all in all, like, I would be proud to shoot several different kinds of bows if I had one. So right now, I'm just shooting old Matthews from about 10 years ago. So what do you think?
I think that in the 2000s, it mattered some.
Yeah.
And I really could see that back then when I was looking at bows and stuff. But now, I mean, everybody gets the technology, and until something new happens, and I don't see how it can, but I'm not an engineer, like, everything's kind of on pace, you know, like, everything's pretty much there. So if you're, like you were saying, if you're shooting a brand that exists pretty much and isn't something that, you know, Jimmy Don made in the warehouse down the street, it's going to probably do the job. Now, there are going to be bows that can, you know, group better or tune better out, you know, with broadhead to 80 yards, and that's a different thing. But if you're trying to shoot a deer at 25 yards, you know, I made this claim to you earlier, but I kind of feel like I could just run up to the retailer, just, you know, the big box store, and buy the ready-made combo that has the sight, rest, bow, and, you know, quiver, everything on there, and just shoot deer and be happy.
Yeah.
However, I'll put the disclaimer out there. I like messing with bow stuff, and I also like going to local shops as opposed to big retailers. So keep that in mind, you know.
But I think,
guys, if you get a chance.
It's archery, right? Like, we're not making iPhones here, so we're not using, I mean, at some point, like, it's got to still be a thing that has string on it and shoots an arrow, right? You know, so
yeah, there are limitations involved. That's the whole point of it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, Tony Grace 913, he says basically applying four tags wears him out. I don't know. I mean, it's definitely tough, man. Like, you got a lot to read. I think that I've got a buddy that he basically, you know, and this is, he's got enough money to do this, but you could do this to some extent. There's a lot of tag companies out there right now that'll help you apply for tags. And I think you tell them what you want and you say, put me in, and make sure it goes right, and, you know, here's my 5-10 year plan, and I'm going to pay you my money, and you give them enough money for whatever service that they're charging to put you in for X amount of tags. You know, this guy actually, you know, pretty much puts in for, you know, major big game species across the entire West and says, put me in the best units. I don't want to draw it unless it's a top-notch tag. And so, and it has worked for him. So, you know, that's how he kind of takes and says, you know, it's, you know, kind of everything I think is like kind of a, you know, money versus time thing. It's like, you know, the reason I'm looking for a lawnmower right now that's expensive is because it's like, well, you know, can I make that money back in time and effort that I would be able to spend elsewhere and with my kids and whatever else? So,
yeah,
that's kind of,
we were talking about that with airline flights earlier. I was telling Eric, I was like, man, I know that there's some cheaper flights that exist, but if you can get somewhere in 2 hours on $50 more, as opposed to taking 7 hours for a little bit cheaper, you know, that time is huge, especially if you're doing what we're going to do, where we go out and film Map Scout Challenge stuff or whatever. You know, that's a whole nother day's worth of work or a whole nother video or whatever. But like you were saying, same thing. If you get home earlier to your kids because you're willing to spend a little extra money.
Yeah.
It makes sense.
Yeah, for sure.
But, same thing with the tag deal. Like, I think that you're a little more well-versed on it than I am. And but I kind of take a minimalist type approach to things. I've kind of found the states that I see that it's decently achievable, and states that you can get some points together for not a lot of money. And I just kind of concentrate on them. And I think I am going to expand that a little bit going forward. But I think that this is kind of a roundabout way to get to this, but I think that fitness is pretty important when you start talking about that kind of stuff, because if you're going to play the application process, you need to make sure you're in it for the long game. And so, it would be good to add a state or two every couple years to something that that you're learning. You know, it's tough to jump in and say, I'm going to apply for 12 new states this year.
Yeah.
You know, but if you're going to spread it out like that, you need to make sure that whenever you're 45 or 50 or 60 or whatever, you know, that you are able to go on these hunts that you're trying to accrue points for now.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that made sense because I made a couple points in there, but you, hopefully you got the gist of what I was saying. Like, don't bite off too much and then make sure that you can sustain yourself long enough to be able to use your points.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Makes sense. Speaking of old Gentry, he had a question for us. This is a very good question. I think it's something that I, you know, I hadn't listened to any podcasts hardly at all that aren't pretty much the Unashamed podcast or something like that, you know, lately. But when I have time, that's kind of what I'm listening to. But anyway, in the past, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, listening to some podcasts about deer hunting and the moon, it is very confusing when these guys that seem to know everything about moon and deer movement and how they interact and correspond, when they get to talking about where the moon should be, it does make make me, or I guess apparently not just me, but it gives some, we need some clarity here. And so Gentry's saying, what do they mean by the moon above and the moon below foot? Is this directly above and below, or what do they mean?
Yeah. So I learned this stuff back whenever I was big time into shark on the beach, because that kind of stuff mattered for that as well with tides and stuff, because you have a double tide, you know, every day pretty much. And you'd get a high tide whenever the moon's directly below feet and whenever it's directly above your head, yada, yada. But what that means is exactly what you're saying. Like, imagine where you are the arms of a clock, and high noon is above your head and 6 PM is at your feet. So when the moon is directly below or directly above. Now, can I correlate that to killing deer? Not so much, but that is what that means. I don't have the moon figured out for deer too much. I do know that, like some of the stuff we do in the rut and late rut, it does seem that when you got a moon at night, you see a little bit less movement in the morning because they were up all night messing around, you know, or they did more messing around possibly.
Right.
I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And I think, you know, our boy HTH talks about the moon, thinks about it quite a bit, and actually because of that, I think is when he shot his Texas public land buck last year. Well, okay, so you like to crack on him, I like to crack on him a little bit too. We have thought that maybe it's because he didn't want to get out of bed early.
Yeah, he also is guilty of that sometimes.
So, but he anyway, essentially what you're saying is that, like, the same concept that he thinks is like, if the deer aren't moving in the morning, then they're moving at midday probably. So I think he ended up shooting that deer at like 11 a.m. And so,
yeah, which is nuts. That's a good buck, man.
Yeah, I know. 6.5-year-old deer, you know, I mean, just that's a cool thing. And so I think that's something to keep in mind is, like, if you get that kind of situation going on, it might be a good time to sleep in, get you a little few extra hours of rest, especially if you're on a trip that you need to kind of refocus and stuff, you know, day three or four. Then you might do that, get out there about 11, take your lunch to the stand and sit through the rest of the day or whatever you want to do there. But that's kind of the idea.
Yeah.
I don't have a whole lot more to add to the moon, though.
Well, okay. But let's think a little bit more about some scouting stuff.
Okay.
Map scouting is a big thing that we do, right? And we are going to, you know, film the Map Scout Challenge stuff again this year. And we've been getting a few questions about, you know, how do you map scout for this state or that state or whatever? Do you have any, like, overarching concepts when it comes to map scouting and just thoughts about, like, you know, just things you look for on a map that says this is a whitetail place?
It kind of, you know, it kind of depends on the country that we're hunting, I guess, regionally in the U.S. I think we've talked about this 100 million times and probably will keep talking about it, but a creek system is a great place, or a river system is a great place to kill deer. And so I think, you know, for me, one reason is because it's a place that can't be farmed a lot of times, so there's cover there for deer. If you can farm corn on it, some point in October, the cover disappears. So it's not that deer don't inhabit that stuff, but at some point they're going to have to get out of it. And so I think, you know, just being able to find cover is something that comes with the creek system, but also water, which is essential to all life, you know, I mean, as essential as anything else. And so that comes with the creek and river system. Another thing, you know, that's something I try to look for. I like hunting bed to food a lot because it gives you a route of travel. And so I like to hunt places that have crops in the area. Also, if it's a really crop heavy state like Illinois or, you know, Ohio, Missouri, something like that, maybe it may not be as easy to figure out the exact bed to food pattern, but it, like, there are big deer there because there's so many crops. Well, right,
if you're in a high deer density area, you can almost just assume that there will be a deer somewhere moving from the place it's sleeping to this food that's in front of me. You know, like, it might not be the only bed to food pattern around, but it's one of them. Right. So yeah, I think that's a big point. One of the things that I really like, and OnX is really great about this with the detailed maps that they have, but I've been doing this a ton for South Dakota, is I'll get on OnX and of course got the public land layer on, and then I will zoom in and just look at kind of the terrain's not really the right word, but habitat, I suppose, would be the right word, like the macro habitat or the biome that we're in. So say you're in a grassland environment, and I'll get on Onyx and I will look for the habitat features that stand out.
Yeah. Yeah.
So not so much terrain, but like if you're in a grassland and over here is a wet spot, you know that the grass is going to be taller in that wet spot. Or over here is what looks like a line of willow trees and there's no other trees around. Or over here, you know, let's take us to a different environment. Say you're, you know, out east or something and you're in pine thickets. Well, over here, suddenly you can see that, man, there's some trees there that don't have leaves on them. I wonder if those are oaks. You know, those things that stick out as being different, you know, or even landmarks. We talk about that a lot, you know, with landmark trees. It might not be a place where you kill a deer, but it's a place you can figure out some stuff about deer. You know, there's going to be scrapes and stuff there. So
put a camera there.
That's one of the things. Yeah, exactly. That's one of the things that I really like to do when I'm, you know, map scouting on X is to go find these little habitat pockets. And the rarer they are, the better they are, you know, because sooner or later they stop being habitat pockets and it just becomes the habitat. Right.
Right.
But I really like this stuff that I've been looking at lately where it's, you know, quite a bit of grasslands. And then once in every 800 acres, there's, you know, just a little island of trees that's kind of in a low spot. I'm like, man, I know that mornings in October are the cliche not thing to do, but you know.
Oh, yeah.
You know there's going to be a deer rolling in there about 9 a.m. To go bed up underneath some of that stuff, you know. And if you can find the mixture of that stuff, I think it's, I think that's a big thing to look for whenever you're, you know, doing a map scouting session in the way we're discussing, where it's a place you've never been to. I think it's a completely different idea to do like what we would do, where there's like, you know, a national forest nearby that we've been to a few times, and then we're like, okay, let's rethink this and think about, you know, a place that might be overlooked or whatever. And that's a different animal.
Yeah.
But a lot of times this time of year, especially, guys are looking at new states and things to do and go and do and explore. And I think that that's kind of a big takeaway for me.
Yeah, that's it's great, dude. I love that a lot. Because I do the same thing. It's just I don't focus sometimes on what I'm doing as much as, like, I'm like, oh, well, I've been here. It's like, you know, you just do it automatically. So maybe I need to think about how I do things a little bit more sometimes.
Well, it's been really cool because you've kind of introduced to me this new system of white hot on dropping pins because I looked today, I have 2,180 pins on OnX.
Oh, my goodness.
The past, the past 5 years since I've been using it. So things are getting a little cluttered. And I wish I had started this earlier, but I needed to be able to organize things a little bit better. And last year, map scouting for South Dakota, I just went in and just splattered everything with red X's. And then we got up there and I was like, well, I don't know if that means that I think it's a good place or I think it's a place of interest or I think that there's food there or what. But, you know, being able to mark something white hot, meaning I'm excited about this place and I haven't been there yet. Mm-hmm. It makes it a big difference. And then you can, of course, use, you know, food or whatever, or point of interest or camp or whatever you want to there, you know. Yeah, but that's kind of what I've been doing in this situation, is I just go through and just, oh, there's a spot of habitat, you know, and just pop that little thing, make it a white and roll. Mm-hmm. And then you can go back and look at it, you know, from a, 30,000 foot view or whatever it is. And you can tell, you know, how things orient compared to access and crops and all that. It's a bigger picture.
Man, there's several reasons, but one reason I really like to use the desktop version of Onyx is that, we've got a lot of different thoughts about this right now, but one reason is when you put a dot on a map that you've never been to, you can quickly, as opposed to being on your phone, you can quickly type in some notes about it. You know, if you learn typing in high school or whatever, right? So, like, I mean, if you're not a two finger typer, you can quickly put a note in there. So that's what helps me a lot. Is like, mm-hmm. we have a slightly different outlook to a lot of things when it comes to hunting or whatever. It's not like, you know, drastic or nothing. We line up on a lot of things too, but like, you know, it's a little bit different. And so like, I'm a little more thorough when I drop pins, and you're kind of like, I'm just going to splatter this map, and that way when I find out for sure where I'm going, I've got 30 options, you know, that, and I don't think that it's any worse than the way I do it. I function better the way I do it. But the good thing is we hunt together a lot. So like, you're talking about just, you know, not just doubling up your opportunity, but exponentially like increasing your success, I think, you know, by doing it two different ways. Yeah. Right. But I like putting those notes. And so that's something I can do very easy on the desktop, you know? So,
absolutely. Man.
T Johnson, 2007, speaking of all this map app stuff, he wants to know a little more about reading terrain features on the map apps. So I think we kind of have talked about how to kind of high level, but let's talk about, you know, when you do that high level scouting, you're looking at what sticks out. All of a sudden, if you got the hybrid on, you look at this terrain thing that sticks out to you. Well, why is it sticking out? And what are you thinking when you see these different features that do stick out on the terrain?
Yeah, I think the two things that I'll notice or see are saddles, and then like the ends of ridges or fingers. And I guess what goes along with that is creeks, right? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, whatever that is. But when you're talking about terrain, like where we live, a lot of times there'll be a terrain feature that you can't even pick up on a map because it's just so small, because the variance in terrain is just not very much, right? But, you know, you go to a lot of places where deer live, saddles are going to be a big deal because it's a path of least resistance, and that's what a deer is looking for, right? And the same thing goes with the end of a finger or ridge. Instead of climbing the ridge to go from point A to point B, a deer will take a longer path to go around the horn of a ridge, right? That's kind of, I guess, what I pick out.
What about you? Yeah, it's similar. You know, like a lot of times I'll see what will catch my eye is just something like where the lines get real close together and they're steep or something. And so I know that like a lot of times if that comes down, if that's the tip of a ridge coming down to a creek, that could be a pretty good pinch right there, just depending on route of travel and where the crops are and everything. So, that's
I don't really remember the Hidden Valley Ranch dressing thing or whatever that Anthony taught us about, but I think depressions are one of the things.
Yeah.
You remember that?
Yeah.
And that's one of the things I've learned about scouting some of this more grassland type habitat is if you turn on the topo layer, you can see like they'll, instead of only paying attention to the topographical lines, they'll actually throw like, of course, you know, you can see the blue where there's lakes and stuff, but usually there'll be like a marsh type looking stuff on there or something, you know, which I'm going to go ahead and say that's kind of a hybrid between a habitat and, you know, topographical feature or terrain feature, you know, because it really is something that you have to navigate around. So it's kind of terrain.
Yeah.
You know, and you might not be able to see that from a map because it just kind of all looks like grass.
Yep. Yeah, for sure. You know, another thing just to kind of give you guys some more excitement, maybe, that are listening to this stuff, is that we have a series that's going to start releasing, I think, later this month. It'll be at least 10 parts, and I think it may end up being a little bit more, but 10-part series, we'll say now, with Onyx, put on by Onyx, that is a podcast series. They're mostly 18 minutes to maybe a couple that are closer to 30, and it's all it's called Public Pens. We've talked about it before, I think last week maybe, but it's a it's everything like about this stuff. It's like, what are, where are good spots that we found, and how do we find them, how do we hunt them, and how do we mark them? And so pretty excited to release that. I hope that's really helpful to you guys and maybe a little bit more elaborate on some of this stuff. So, but thanks for the question, T. Johnson, 2007.
Tyler, let me ask you this while we're talking about Abtec and stuff like that. There was a question in relation to buck bedding. This is like Northeast Texas Hunting on Instagram or something like that. I don't know who that is, but it's a good question. If you want to relate it back to Texas, how much emphasis are you putting on bedding in Texas?
Buck bedding, I guess?
Yeah, buck bedding.
Okay. In Texas, I don't hardly put anything on buck bedding unless I've seen a buck kind of go to bed that that morning, you know. I mean, I don't think about it too much, really, because, I don't know, when we hunt in Texas, it's like kind of just finding bedding generally, you know, like it's like this is thick habitat, lots of greenbrier or lots of, you know, blue stem or whatever it might be. A lot of times if it's early season, you're going to want some shade involved with that too. That would be via like oak trees or whatever. But like mainly we think more like, okay, well here's a possible food source. And where would these deer be coming from? And so that almost always lines up with, you know, at least a half mile from the road in most cases, if not further. That would be where we would assume bedding is. And it also happens to be super thick with blackberries and stuff like, you know, blackberry brambles or whatever you want to call them, briars and thick stuff like that. But the thing is, man, like, is it's just not, there's enough of that stuff in a lot of these places we hunt that it's a guess from day to day. Like,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, even still, like, even you're talking about even doe bedding or doe family groups. For doe bedding, like they may bed there one day, and the next day for the next 4 days or more, they don't bed there again, you know? Mm-hmm. And so they bed, you know, 600 yards away or whatever. It's just, it makes it really tough. I'm sorry. I don't have a great answer for that, but I don't put a lot of stock into that. That's for sure.
You kind of killed deer this year though, in Texas, because you saw a buck and assumed kind of the general area. You saw him go back to bed and made a move to go over there, and it's possibly the deer you ended up killing. It's a giant. You know?
I mean, it definitely, you know, it's kind of one of those MRI things that we talk about from, you know, we've gotten from Mark Drury, like most recent information. If something happens that shows you, you know, I was talking to a buddy recently talking to him on Instagram, and then we exchanged numbers and I got talking to him, and he was like, man, he's like, the biggest deer I've ever gotten a shot at, I literally, you know, walk into this spot just kind of on a whim, and everything was shredded. You could tell fresh sign deer was in there. And he's like, I just literally just set up, you know, not very high on a trail, and in no time, this giant comes out, you know? And so, you know, I mean, that's obviously, that takes a little guts, especially if you're not very experienced, to do something like that. And it's a chance, but it could reward pretty highly. And I think, you know, that was the case on that deer this year. But, you know, there's, I don't know. It's tough in Texas a lot of times, and it's tough in other places in the South and stuff.
There's some patterning you could do though in this situation where I don't think that, it's worth the time or effort to find a specific buck bed in Texas. If you do find one, don't ignore it. But I think narrowing it down could be a huge thing, and that could be more trail oriented than anything. you know, and it's a great situation to implement a game cam where I can think back to whenever we were trying to find Teenager, which was a buck you chased around on Texas Republic for a while. You know, following him back with a trail camera and kind of get to a spot where you know he's at least daylight active, which probably means fairly close to his bedding.
Yeah.
And, you know, you could set up something like even, you know, nowadays with cell cameras, you know, Moultrie's coming out with this Delta that's supposed to be, you know, bad to the bone for about $100. And, you know, you could have something like that in there where you don't even have to go in and, you know, possibly throw scent around.
Yeah.
And be able to kind of monitor if a deer is going back to bed to a certain spot and if he's daylight active very much, and be able to, you know, probably at least make an assumption as to where his bedding is and then go in there with some of that camera data and say, okay, well, on west winds, he likes to bed in this spot because the camera told me so. So I'm going to go in there and, you know, extract that sucker as opposed to just jumping around.
Yeah. And here's another thing is, you know, we talked to Jeff Sturgis a while back about some of this stuff, and he mentioned, you know, how deer have these kind of these, I forget what he calls them, but it's like, you know, these rounds that they make that may take like 4 days or a week or whatever. And so like a lot of times you'll see a big deer like every 4 days on a camera. And so if you're seeing that, you know, what you may do is, you know, if you got the cell cam out, if he shows up one day, you could hunt the next day in hopes. And then the next day you might go to work. And then, you know, and the day after or the day after that, then you get back in the woods. And, you know, if you're seeing him every 4 days or something like that on camera, you try to hunt those few days around when you assume 4 days is from the last time he showed up or whatever, you know. So that's where a cell cam could come in pretty handy for sure, is seeing, you know, okay, he was there today. That means in, you know, 3 days I need to be there again, and I need to hunt about three straight days, and there's a good chance I get him, you know. So,
yeah.
Which is kind of what I did with One-Eyed Jack, you know. I mean, I knew he was in the area, and I just hunted a pretty much the same location 5 days straight and got it done on that last day, you know. And so that can work, I think. You know, people don't talk about that a lot. They like to talk about the first day in, but if the first day in is, you know, if your wind's pretty foolproof and your access is good and you don't get him on the first day in, then it's probably not because you spooked him, you know, if you feel comfortable about your access and your wind. So another – speaking of kind of what we're talking about here with the bedding areas, Nick, the Guad American, on Instagram, he wants to know a little more about determining bedding areas on the ground and on Onyx, and then also picking trails to set up on. And I think, like, I guess to continue on what we're talking about here with the bedding is one thing, this is similar to what Casey was saying, but one thing I guess is a elaborate, part of this is, I would say that, like, a lot of times if you are hunting on a creek system, then you have – and if you have a food source of some sort that you can determine that you're seeing that deer at or whatever, you know, a lot of times on those creek systems, right up next to the creek is a good place for deer to bed because it grows really thick with vines and stuff like that, you know, and in certain spots along that creek. We've seen that hunting Teenager quite a bit. And you'll find that – you may not be able to know exactly which little thicket that deer is on that creek, but if you hunt down the creek, you're hunting him on any of those bedding areas for several hundred yards, possibly, especially if it's a cold front and he's going to get up early and move quite a bit before dark, you know? So maybe something to think about there. What are other ways you have determined buck bedding, or I guess bedding areas, it doesn't say buck bedding, but bedding areas on the ground or even on X?
Rubs. I think rubs tell you quite a bit. If you see a spot that's pretty torn up with, you know, here and there and everywhere, little rubs, I think that you're probably pretty close to some bedding. It might be doe or buck, kind of depending on the specific situation. But that's something we found this winter, I think, in one spot that we're pretty excited about. There was a ton of rubs on little stuff on this one little kind of island and of habitat. And I think that probably tells you something. The direction of the rubs is something I still pay attention to. It's not killed me a deer yet, but I really do believe that there's something to it. You know, if the rub is on, if you're looking for bedding, at least. Now, you can't say this on like a tree that's in the middle of a field, right? But if the rub up in a thicket is on, say, the east side, you can assume that that deer was traveling west whenever he made the rub, right? So there's something to that route of travel and where he's at and that sort of thing. So that's a thought as well. As far as picking the right trail and associated with bedding, that's a hard thing to do where we live, especially. So I think my take, and this is something that you did in Iowa that killed you deer, is make sure that you are set up to shoot as many trails as you can, you know, and of course, make sure you're set up to shoot the best one, but don't just sell out for it if there's another decent one close. You know, try to set up where you can shoot both. This year, in December, this is stuff that hasn't come out yet on YouTube, but it will later. I like just got outwitted pretty much, or not wit really, but just guessed wrong a whole lot on which trails to set up on, and had deer take the opposite ones of the two that I could shoot to a couple times. You know, it was kind of ridiculous, but it's just one of those things you kind of have to almost guess and check sometimes. And that's why I guess you go back to some of that access stuff and making sure that you go in and out pretty clean and not just mess it up real bad.
Yeah. I mean, that you nailed it, I think. You know, I mean, if there's three trails, try to get a shot to all three of them, you know, somehow. You know, you leave one on the downwind side and just, you know, you're hoping that you can get a shot before it gets to your wind. And hopefully you set up that way too. You know, don't pick the tree that doesn't give you any shots until it gets your wind on that trail, you know, if you can help it. So that's kind of the best way. I don't think there's a, there's some tips, but I don't think there's any way to just, you know, say I'm picking the right trail, you know, 100% of the time. Because that's just, that's difficult in most places, you know, but a lot of times you can also, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, even in a situation where, like, say you saw a buck go to bed down this trail the evening before, and you're assuming where he's at, you don't have control of what he does for like 6 hours of the day.
Yeah.
He might, you know, go across a saddle or something and come down the other trail, even though you think you got it in the bag.
Yeah.
You know,
like, might get spooked.
Deer is unpredictable.
Yeah. Might get spooked at bedding. It's a farmer might drive a truck up, you know?
Yeah. Exactly. So. Some clown goes in there stomping around shooting squirrels, you know?
Yeah.
You know, like, there's all kinds of variables.
Dang, I'm squirrel hunters.
Like staying in the woods is one of the important things. You just need to hunt.
Yeah, and you can also, you know, you can also find a way to kind of like, depending on lots of factors, the weather and time of year and stuff like that, you know, you can take and look at a map and see trails sometimes. And if you see three trails, they're going to join at some point probably if they're running parallel. So you can find, you can find funnels that do that, and you can also find the closer you get to that, to the actual food source, destination food, a lot of times those trails will start to really come together.
Yeah, so. I think we actually talk about that in one of those public pens podcasts that you were mentioning about earlier. That would be pretty cool. So whenever you find that spot, Tyler, I'm guessing you're probably going to be in a tree saddle. Which tree saddle are you going to sit in?
I will be, this year, I'll be in a cruiser saddle. I think we did a video recently where we did a comparison between the cruiser and two other saddles. And, I mean, I've talked about it before several times, but this, the ownership with Chad, really like that guy, really think about things the same way and, you know, across the board, really. And the saddle... out of the ones I've had on, it truly is the most comfortable saddle. So I'm excited to lay up in one of them things and hopefully get a few shots this year.
Which cruiser saddle?
I'll be in the XC, I think. I think that's the one that I'll probably be in for the most part. But I'll probably try both of them here and there just to make sure I'm getting the best of my options, you know? What about you?
I'll be in XC as well. I think the Archon is cool, but didn't see a ton of benefit and didn't think that I needed a two-piece saddle for anything. So, and I know Chad is a XC guy as well. In that video, we tried to be as unbiased as possible and just kind of be frank about the things that each saddle offered. Mm-hmm. But since y'all listen to this podcast, we can be a little bit more candid with, you know, kind of what we thought. There was a budget option in there, and there's a real popular option in there, and you kind of saw which ones were what. And then the Cruiser, which is kind of I'm glad that we're working with Cruiser, honestly, because they on the up and up, man. People, like, I'm on some of the Facebook groups, and people are like, you know, what I need to try, and everybody's like, Cruiser, it's so comfortable. I was like, well, that's good. I guess that we aren't wrong whenever we say that, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Dude, it really has. Like, it was crazy to me how many comments we even got on the video when we first, you know, put that thing out. And people were like, y'all have to try these things, you know? So,
yeah, exactly.
We listen.
I think that's one of the things that we're going to be totally transparent about is that, you know, we're in a partnership with Chad and them over at Cruiser. But we kind of had some options there.
Yeah.
And, man, the brands just lined up so good. And our beliefs, you know, Chad's a Christian guy, and he wants to do things right, wants to do his best for, you know, his company and for his employees. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it was just a, you know, not that any of the others don't, but just, it would just lined up so good and just fell into place. So
that's right,
we're excited about that, man.
Yes, I am too, man. I cannot wait to, we're actually going to be in South Dakota with him. So I can't wait to get to do that and finally actually formally meet him. You know, it's kind of like,
oh yeah,
you feel like you actually, you know somebody pretty well sometimes when you talk to them on the phone enough, but still it's always good to meet them and hang out with them and get some of that camaraderie in camp. And I think we're going to hold church a couple times as well while we're up there. So
maybe the whole time too.
Yeah, for sure, man. For sure.
Yeah.
So let's talk about this. This kind of goes hand in hand with what we've been talking about a little bit. We're talking about identifying bedding and stuff like that on public. There's a lot of people that listen this podcast that hunt Texas public land because we do, and we kind of can all just share in this community and help each other out. And so I don't know a whole lot of other people that are hunting Texas public land much that do this. So we appreciate you guys' support and the questions. Mo in Austin says, how do you find buck sign on Texas public land?
You know, I saw this come up in one of the Facebook groups the other day. Some guy was kind of having a hard time. Honestly, my answer might be just a little bit too vague, but my answer is to cover a lot of ground in your summer scouting and maybe your postseason scouting. Postseason is when it's going to be most apparent, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that having a hard time finding buck sign, not that you haven't put in some hard work, but maybe you need to just – make sure you're checking out all the different types of habitat around there and just, you know, maybe set out a day, throw a couple water bottles and some snacks in your bag and just really get after it, because there's deer around. And if you do that and still don't find buck sign, you might think about moving a few miles.
Yeah.
You know, because maybe there's just not – doesn't have everything that bucks want or need.
That's right. That's exactly right, man. I think the best time to find buck sign is postseason, or even scouting your way in during the season. But, you know, postseason,
that's the thing you can do. But at the same time, I think as a guy who hunts public land and tries to be considered to other guys that hunt public land, if you go in there and tear stuff up too much scouting in season, you could kind of mess some other people up,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Both who are in the stand and who else or have just done their homework preseason or postseason.
Yeah,
so
for sure.
Not saying you can't do it, you know, but just be mindful of it.
Yeah, you have the right to, but, you know, yeah. It's kind of one of those things, like, what does your conscience tell you about that? So, but, yeah, I think that postseason time is the way to do it, because all the signs fresh, nothing's growing up. But I think you also got to be, like, throw a 20-gauge on your back, and that's fine, but don't be looking up in the trees the whole time if you really want to find buck sign. You know, like, focus on what you're focusing on, and if an opportunity arises in front of you and a squirrel jumps into a tree, do that, you know, but then get back on track. Don't let it ruin, like, don't let it take your whole day and take your attention. You know, we almost had that happen in Indiana when we did our Map Scout Challenge there a few weeks back. You found a morel right off the bat, and all of a sudden it's like, who cares about this Map Scout Challenge? You know, it's like,
that's right. So
it was tough. It was tough. But I agree with KC 100%. You got to cover ground. And if you're not seeing it, it's a mature buck especially, or decently mature buck, needs you know, he needs food, water. He needs does to be somewhere that are accessible at some point during the year. And then he needs to not be bothered really more than anything, just about, because especially in Texas, which I believe is what we're talking about here, you're gonna have a lot of the factors that you need in most places, but the remoteness or the, you know, the ability to be left alone is what really matters in most of these situations. So
for sure.
What about kind of same deal? We're talking about Texas again, but I think this, some of these things can be applied all over the place. But patterning deer in Texas big woods where there's no clear bed to food. This is D. Miller, D3 sign. Thank you for the question. We hunt this kind of stuff quite a bit. There's no clear bed to food. Are you able to pattern deer? And if not, how are you hunting them?
Question, is there a pattern if there's no bed to food? Because a deer has no reason to create a pattern.
Exactly.
And deer are good at surviving, so they know, whether it is conscious or otherwise, that being on a pattern makes them more killable, whether it's by us or by predators or whatever, right? So I would think that deer probably prefer to not have to travel to one specific destination. Mm-hmm. They'd rather just be able to mill around and find some food. And I really think that, you know, deer kind of have this thing where they get a little bit bored and want to walk around some. But for the most part, like a big buck, the reason he's a big buck is he knows to not make mistakes. And if he's like, you know, pretty old, if he can figure out how to live in one acre and be happy his whole life, he's going to do it. Mm-hmm. So in the big woods scenario, I guess to kind of bring it back to the question, for me, I think you're hunting seasonal patterns more than you're hunting a daily pattern. Mm-hmm. So you're hunting a situation where you know that, man, it's you know, early season, it's hot, I'm going to go find a water hole. And I think we have a podcast from way back where we talked to Eric Barber, who was with Midwest Whitetail back then. Now he works for Vortex, where we talked to him a lot about this. And he kills a deer in Wisconsin, I believe, over a water hole that he made in the big woods, mm-hmm. you know. And so you know that deer are going to want water, and then you push it. Of course, in the rut, you know, what are they going to be doing? They're going to be running around, right? But before that and after that, they're going to be finding whatever acorn trees fall in, or persimmons or whatever it might be. So I think that you're hunting, like I said, that seasonal thought as opposed to like a daily pattern. You have any other thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would say, like, you say this a lot, and it makes so much sense, but like deer do deer things because they're deer, you know, or something along the sort of that, you know, like it basically, you know, look for an edge somewhere. And when I say an edge, like some group of trees that's different, you know, like a lot of times, you know, if you're hunting stuff that we're hunting, a lot of times it'll be lots of post oaks. And then there will be, you'll find like some kind of lowland stuff that's got this like foot and a half grass growing all in it, and it's a bunch of ash trees and maybe some hackberry and cedar elm or something. It's a little bit different kind of woods.
Like, are they on little ash trees?
They are little ones. Okay. they're not big ones usually, but sometimes they are. But yeah, so like finding, you know, wherever the edge is, there is a spot to start focusing on, and put some cameras out and figure if that's a spot that you even need to be, you know, hunting or spending any time in the woods. And then, you know, I would say also, like, a lot of the places we hunt, they kind of hunt like big woods, but they do have maybe some creeks or draws running through them or whatever. And like you said, they might lead to a food source or something like that. A water source. And if that's the case, you know, like the bottom side of that water might be a good place that, you know, essentially deer will use that dam of that pond or whatever, if it's made as an old cattle tank or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then also on, you know, the creek side of that thing, there will be like wherever that creek heads out in that big wood section and starts to really kind of flatten out, there will be a place where you start to see deer going across that creek. As opposed, you know, like where they won't go across it south of there, you know, for the for 300 yards all the way down to that pond. But then, you know, you go from that pond up 300 yards and there's a spot where it flattens out, and the deer go across. So look for little things like that. You can find that stuff on the Onyx, app, obviously, by turning the just straight topo. You can find those creeks in the blue lines that are going, or just look at the elevation lines.
I actually targeted a place like that in the old sandwich buck hunt this year.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was I did an all-day hunt. And I didn't see much, except I did go in. It was kind of a late rut scenario here in Texas, which is a little bit later. That's, that's pushing December around here. But I was sitting in the saddle midday and had set up in a situation where upstream of me, the creek banks were steeper. Downstream of me, the creek banks were steeper, and it was thicker habitat. But I knew that there was like an 80-yard section right there where it was flatter on both sides. And lo and behold, the rut fest came through at like 12:05 p.m., just high noon. And one of the biggest bucks, probably the biggest buck I've seen in person on Texas public land, ran underneath my stand so fast that I couldn't do anything about it.
Dude, and we're talking so fast.
So fast.
How close were those deer?
15 yards.
Oh, my goodness, dude.
Yeah, make you cry. I was macking that thing so hard. It's Mac City, Texas. So another Texas question.
Okay.
That came in on the Instagram feed from Bearfit. He wanted to know if we ever use snort weeds in Texas.
Is this Bear, B-A-R-E?
B-A-I-R.
Oh, good, because I was hoping this wasn't like Naked Fit or something,
it might be. I don't know.
Okay. I'm trying to think. I mean, I've used it for sure. I'm trying to think if I've used it effectively ever. What about you?
Yeah.
Do you have any?
I lay off of it because I've never had it work, but that doesn't mean it doesn't, because – you kind of talked about the thing I say about deer because they're deer or whatever, whitetails are whitetails and they are a species, and every member of that species within its own sex is able to do the same thing as the other one. Right. So I don't know if does can snort wheeze, but every buck that exists can snort wheeze.
Mm-hmm.
It's a thing they do. And it's probably more, I guess not physically limited, but does just don't have that imprinted on them to do that. But I guess what I'm saying is, it doesn't matter if you're in Maine or you're in South Texas, they can do it. And you and I were hunting in public land where I passed a deer I shouldn't have, who snort wheezed underneath our stand in Texas last year.
Yeah.
So it's a thing that happens. Now, you're going to have to, if you want it to happen or to work effectively, you probably need to make sure that the deer are in the right frame of mind, and it might be, it's not probably a calendar thing, at least by day. It is by month. I would say to do it in November and December.
Mm-hmm.
That's the time you're going to want to do it if you do use it. But I mean, if the buck is chilling and he's, eating some acorns and he ain't got any aggression on his mind, a snort wheeze probably ain't going to do much for him. But say you got a buck that's chasing at like 45 yards and maybe he has had to run off a little buck or something, and you've seen all this happen from the stand in Texas and you can't get him to come over, or you want to make sure that you send a message to him, I think it's a chance to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't just roll through the woods throwing him out there thinking that you're going to get a good old Iowa response to the snort wheeze.
Yeah, I think you're right. 100%. I mean, I don't know that I've ever – I think for me, if I'm trying to call a deer on Texas pub, it's a grunt. And I'll be honest, I hunted a private piece of property in East Texas last year quite a bit that had – it didn't have – like it had several decent bucks on it that, are competing for does or whatever, and not – I don't think I saw a deer with a broken tine. I mean, so they're not like challenging each other all that often. Like there's several, there were several 2 and 3 year old, basket eights that are 11 to 14 or 15 inches wide. And none of them were broken. None of the big ones are broken. None of the little ones were broken really. It was just like, I don't think that they're, I think they, they figure out their pecking order pretty well, and they're just, I don't know, it's weird, man. It's just a different kind of subspecies of white-tailed deer that just isn't as bully.
Oh, here we go.
There you go. Subspecies. I know. Striped marlin, blue marlin, they're all the same.
I'm with you. I think that if you wanted to put it in terms of like humans, like deer have culture, right? And the culture that of deer down here is just not that. It's not competing for does. If anything, especially in East Texas, we're seeing it change a little bit, but for so long, the buck to doe ratio was just out of whack in most places so badly that the bucks had more does than they could even mess with.
Yeah.
You know, so they didn't have any reason to compete.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, you want Susie? I'll take Jill. You know, like it's just like,
yeah,
they didn't have that.
And we probably still have the same thing kind of going on, you know, so.
Yeah. And especially on public land where it seems that people are shooting more bucks than they are does. You know, I think that you find in Texas private situations, people really take advantage, probably because they can, you know, use a rifle, but we have, you know, dates where you can shoot does and people are doing that. So there's a little bit better, more balance, but
yeah,
I mean, we can account for it. I bet you I've seen 2-1 bucks versus does on public land in Texas. It's just does are kind of, I don't know.
Yeah.
So it's,
let's broaden this thing out a little bit.
Yeah.
For people who may not be hunting Texas, how do you find bedding on very large pieces of pub? I mean, I have a pretty simple thought about this. You know, I mean, I think for me that if I can find a very large piece of public, I'm excited about it because all, you know, like you got so many options. Just, you know, I know it's overwhelming sometimes, but just focus on, like KC said, which is great. And I mean, I do it. I just hadn't thought about it, but like just zoom out and what draws your attention first and then zoom in and focus on that small piece, you know, that 100 acres or whatever it is, and figure out where a deer might be bedding and why that stuck out to you. I mean, I don't know as far as bedding goes, you know, like you can learn to identify the thick stuff based off of your on the ground scouting a lot of times, I think.
Yeah. And going in and hog hunting or squirrel hunting helps tell you that too, because you're going to end up walking through something. You're like, oh, okay, this makes sense. But at the same time, I don't think you can figure out day to day very good because, I mean, you take that stand. I shot that spike in, I guess that was 2019, wasn't it?
Or 2018? No, 2019. It was 2019.
January 1, 2019. Yeah, January 1, 2019, I shot a spike that bedded in front of the stand. And that's a stand I'd hunted probably 30 times before that. And I'd never seen a deer bed there, right? So, like, it's sporadic, to say the least. So I think daily you're going to have a difficult time, but finding habitat that you believe is thick enough for bedding is definitely something you can do. Now, was the question specific to map scouting?
I don't think so. What I've got written here is, how do you find bedding on very large pieces of public land? You know?
I think that if you're new to a spot or you want to rethink it, I think you could get on X and kind of go with the Newberg model for elk, but do it for whitetail and just find your parking places or access points and draw, you know, a radius or use that line tool or whatever and just say, okay, well, here's a half mile from that thing. So I'm just going to write those off and I'm not going to spend much time there. Not saying there aren't deer to be killed there and so forth, but if you're trying to narrow it down some, that might help you to just start out and just put yourself in better odds of finding bedding. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I think that's good. I mean, I think I think another thing real quick, if you go out and stomp around in the middle of the day, if you are able to, you know, work into the wind, and if you're able to jump deer, they probably jumped out of a bed. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So kind of a thought there. But
yeah. Oh, you know, Eric Gentry brought up a good point with that I'd never thought of, and I don't know if he heard it or thought of it, but he said, you know, if you jump a buck from his bed and he doesn't die, he thinks that's a success. You know, that bed worked for him. And I was like, I never thought about it that way. I always felt bad about bumping deer, you know, because they're like, oh, no, getting intruded on. And I would imagine you can't do it every day.
Right.
But, you know, if he is comfortable in his bed and you bump him once, he probably was like, hey, it worked. You know, I didn't get eaten.
Yep.
So,
yep.
Yeah.
Kind of cool. What do you think about, we've done a video on this, but your go-to pack for saddle hunting that you're able to carry sticks and camera gear and stand and whatever else, you know?
Yeah, I think that a lot of them will work, you know, but, man, I do like that Sitka tool belt, you know, and I've been talking to
Chris.
I'm blanking. Chris, yeah, I've been talking to Chris, thank you, about that some and kind of talking about the design and beefing it up in a couple places or whatever. I don't think you're going to get the Element Edition from Sitka or anything, but we have been talking about it some, and I think that for most hunts, that thing is just pretty hard to beat, man, because the idea of having a saddle is being lightweight and mobile. And if you got a big old bulky pack and you got a whole bunch of stuff weighing you down, well, you might as well have a 12-pound stand strap to it too, because it's not that much different, right? But having that thing on you, you're just not committed so much that you feel like you have to go get in the tree still. Like, you can make a stalk with that thing on, or you know what I mean? And it's just so low profile. I have narrow hips, and it still doesn't hang out past my hips.
Yep.
I'm not catching on anything, you know. It's just and it's comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just hard to beat, really.
Yeah, it is, man. I like it too. That's the one I used pretty much all year until it got snowy on me in Kansas in December. And I upgraded to a little bit heavier duty pack because I was carrying more clothes.
Grabbed your snow Cephas pack.
That's what I did. So, but I'm with you. I think pretty much anything, you know.
So that, on the gear vein with that, you know, kind of heading in a different direction a little bit, but what's a heavy arrow, Tyler?
It's an arrow that's heavy.
Yeah. And is there a definition to it, or is there a way to explain it?
I think that is a obviously a objective thing to look at. But I think that a lot of people would agree at some point it becomes heavy for most people. Now, you've got your public land snobs, you got your heavy arrow snobs that,
oh yeah,
you know, if you're not shooting 600 grains, it ain't heavy or whatever.
Yeah.
But I think you would have a lot more to say about this than I would probably.
Yeah, but you have made the transition to heavier more recently than I have.
Yeah.
Are you a heavy arrow believer?
Yes, I am. But I don't think I actually think that I want to decrease my weight this year from what I've been at, and I haven't been like super heavy or anything, but I just want to shoot a little bit flatter trajectory because I'm hanging out of a saddle in a tiny tree trying to get ranges on deer, you know, and if I'm 7 yards off at distance, then that can make a difference. So,
yeah.
And it did last year, I felt like, to an extent for me in a particular situation or two. But, yeah, that's kind of where I want to get to, shoot a little bit flatter arrow, but I do want still to be heavier than what I used to be. Just because I like the penetration and some of the options or some of the things that gives me, I guess.
Oh, yeah, and with tuning stuff too, it's huge.
Yeah,
we'll talk about that in a second. But I kind of want to approach this from a different direction. I think it's pretty hard to put a number on heavy arrow because it's so subjective depending on what your draw weight and draw length and all that stuff is too, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think really what a heavy arrow is that arrow that you've stopped worrying about speed and you start worrying about things that actually matter more.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when you end up with a heavy arrow. So like for instance, let's take my mom. My mom hunts some and, she is not a very tall person or a long draw length and can't draw a lot of weight. So for her, something in the mid 400s is going to be pretty heavy and she's still going to be, you know, kind of lobbing them out there, and she doesn't need to shoot 650, you know, because they're just not going to go any further than 10 yards with what she
yeah.
shoots, you know? So that doesn't make sense. But what she does need to worry about is, you know, penetration and tuning and that sort of thing, you know, and I think that that's going to make a big difference. You know, for me, I'm going to be in the low to mid 500s is where I like to be. That's, you know, and that ends up tacking out around 255 or something, 260, depending on what bow it is. And that's another big talk. But in general, what I really like about a heavy arrow is how well it tunes your bow and how quiet it makes your bow. I don't, were you there that time we were at the bow shop and I was shooting these arrows and guys were like, man, your bow's quiet. What bow is that? I was like, well, it doesn't matter what bow it is. Were you there?
No, I was not. I think that might have been when you chunked your – no, that wasn't it. Yeah.
I think you were in there talking to Brian or something.
Oh, maybe, yeah.
But the guys were like, man, it's so quiet. And what bow is that? And I was like, well, it doesn't matter what bow it is. It's because it's slower. That's why it's quiet, because I'm shooting a heavy arrow. And that heavy arrow just means that the bow's not exploding in my hand, you know? But, you know, to kind of go back to what you were wanting to do, Vector is who we're going to shoot this year. We're going to shoot Vector Custom Shop. And Isaac has been talking to us a ton about some of these options that we have. They have a arrow weight calculator and all kinds of stuff that they are putting on their website that will really help you if you're kind of interested in the heavy arrows, but you don't really know what to do or where to go. And FOC is an acronym you're not familiar with and all this stuff, right? But he actually has a couple options, and it's not just like, well, here's the arrow for you. Like, say, for Tyler, you're wanting to maybe not shoot something quite as heavy, but still have the benefits of a heavier arrow setup. Well, you can take and do some tricks to different spine weights and different GPIs and stuff like that to come out with an arrow that's, you know, maybe 40 or 50 grains heavier than mine, but still getting a lot of the benefits of it, right? And that's what's cool. It's not just like a, well, here it is. Here's what your option with your bow. It's a much more customized approach to, what are your needs? What are your wants? You know, are you trying to shoot water buffalo or are you trying to shoot whitetails? You know, and I think that there's definitely a world where those are different situations.
Absolutely.
Right? So, again, in full disclosure, we're working with Vector. Like, they're partners with us. They're helping us do things this season. They're helping you as well if you want to try out some Vectors. They have a test package, which is real sweet. He'll send you two that are a little bit different from each other. You know, maybe one's a little heavier, one's a little lighter, and you can see which one tunes the best out of your bow, you know, three fletch, four fletch, whatever you select. But overall, if you put in code ELEMENT, all caps, you'll get 10% off your order. So go check that out. Support Isaac. He's another good dude and really a technician when it comes to this stuff. He has a big history in competitive archery, has been hunting for 7 years now, I think, or something like that.
Yeah.
But is really taking a deep dive into this stuff because he just kind of likes to nerd out about it, and I do too. So it's a good pairing, really. Those hammers are flying well out of the bow, man. I'm excited about them.
Sweet.
And I'm ready to actually hammer something with one.
Oh yeah, me too, man. I can't
not
wait.
Far off, dude.
I know. I can't wait. You know, I got a couple more minutes here before I got to go watch the Lady Cats win the state championship. But we got a couple of questions right here. The last one with the saddle for the pack for the saddle hunting was Ryan Collinger. Sorry if I mispronounced that. But let's see. Tricky Tross wants to know if you've ever grown any black crim maters.
I have got a couple black crims this year.
Me too. Thanks to you.
I'm interested to see how they compare to the old Cherokee purple. I feel like they're going to be pretty similar.
Yeah. I like Cherokees for sure. So I'm excited about them. I'm in the same boat. Austin Soggett says he wants to know about finding the right big buck holding habitats. I think we've talked about a lot of that on this episode. You know, I know that's not necessarily bedding, but, you know, and maybe transitioning into the food and a staging area and stuff. You know, I think a deer likes to be able to see because it's got a good eyesight, but it also needs some cover to be able to slip into really quick. Any other thoughts that you have about that?
Not really, just proximity to resources.
Yeah.
Probably would be the big thing.
For sure. Okay, so two more here that I've got.
Okay.
You know, I said, what are confusing things about deer for you? And Jay Sawyer says, Insta hunters doing it for likes and also people not researching the conservation orgs. He named a few of them. I don't know how many of them you want to name, but Go ahead.
I will go ahead and tell y'all, stop giving your money to BHA.
Yeah.
I'll say it right now. You know, it's not good.
Yeah.
Do your research on it. Don't take my word for it. But, yeah.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. That's a tough thing to do, but you want to research, you know, every once in a while. We've talked about this before, but I think you got to research, and when you feel comfortable about it, you know you're probably good for a couple of years, and then you may research that organization again before you re-up, you know, or whatever.
Yeah, there's this thing where, like, people see something become popular, so they want to gain power, so they move themselves up the chain of power until they start making decisions, and suddenly an organization becomes something it wasn't.
Yeah.
And that's a bad thing.
For sure. Insta hunters doing it for likes. Yeah, I know those are out there, and we get kind of tired of them too. There is also a dynamic that, you know, some people are actually – you know, they make a living off of this stuff. And if they're honest and have integrity, then they kind of, you know, it doesn't bother me too much. If they are kind of hoping for their posts to do well, you know, cause I know we hope that our posts do well, but,
we're not doing it for the likes cause we don't get a ton of them. So you
that's right. Yeah. So that's, I do like people that do it, with integrity and stuff, but if they're kind of, I mean, I know who you're talking about, not necessarily in particular, but the type and it's frustrating. It definitely is. Cause, hunting means a lot to us and what it's a part of what we do and what we love, and so it's hard to see that kind of get contaminated by booty pics and stuff like that, I guess. So, you know, I understand it, but do you have any more questions, or how are you feeling?
I think that is what I have seen come in. If y'all have more questions,
I've got one more good one though.
Some Instagram page called Season Hunting wants to know why TPWD refuses to follow the science. Do you know anything about that?
I don't know anything about that Instagram page, but know that, you know, there definitely has been some issues where the public comment has been disregarded, I think. So I'm not trying to dog on them, but there's a little disconnect between the people on the ground, the biologists, and probably Austin in politics, right? So
yeah, well, let them out while you're down there.
I'm going. I'm actually heading down there right after the game.
Good. just stand on the steps till I talk to you.
I think if I just stand there, they'll probably bring news cameras out and stuff. And
right.
I mean, that's what it looks like to me, is that news cameras follow people that stand on the Capitol steps all the time, you know? So
yeah, you should do that.
I think I will.
I'll just let you answer this because our answer is probably going to be similar. When is the rut for whitetail?
That definitely depends on where you're at. But for the majority of the country, I think you can – it also depends on what your definition is the rut. The rut is, in most people's cases, they are thinking of it as the time where you see the most movement in bucks, right?
Uh-huh.
The most crazy movement. It's not necessarily coincided with actual peak breeding, but it's very close. It's within days a lot of times. And so I would say most of the country, you're talking about – November 1 through November 14th or something like that. Maybe I could say the first 2 weeks of November.
And as you move further south, that spreads out some.
Yes.
And then if you're in a Gulf Coast state, you need to check the map because it gets kind of crazy down there.
Yes. Yeah. And that includes Texas.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah. That's probably that. I guess that's the best I can give you on the rut stuff. We actually did an episode with Lindsay Thomas Jr. of the formerly of the QDMA, now of the NDA.
Still works, or changed the name.
Do what?
But he still works, so they just changed the name.
Yeah, exactly. So it's but it was on all the rut stuff, crazy rut, and why the rut is what it is, and everything. So anyway, you can definitely check that out. The last question we've got here, Casey, this was for you. Is old Purvis TX wants to know what the consensus is on the Little Debbie oatmeal cereal?
Man, I didn't buy them. I think we're gonna hold off on that for one of the hunt trips and get the whole Element crew in on it. But somewhere, there is a Little Debbie oatmeal cream pie cereal out there, and honestly, I would like to know Tyler's opinion on them. So that's why I'm waiting, because you are the true connoisseur of cereals.
Dang right. Yeah. I love cereal so much. It's not. It's
cereal proud, bro. It's proud about for sure. So
yeah, yep. It's the best. So yeah, that's all the questions that we've got right now. Keep sending them in if you're listening to this and you have one. Just find a way to comment it or DM it to us. We appreciate you guys being a part of this thing, man. This is fun for us. I will really enjoy the Q&A stuff. Good questions, guys. And, you know, definitely check out some of these hunt breakdowns we're doing. Hopefully they're videos on YouTube, and hopefully they'll give you a good idea of how to be successful. And maybe they'll answer some of these questions for you, and you'll get to see us kind of view our own selves being idiots sometimes and sometimes figuring it out and, you know, all that. We got some gear reviews that are coming out this summer, and then, I mean, we're getting ready. It's pretty much about time to start putting out cameras or start getting them ready to put out, because they're gonna be adding points here real quick to the racks. So
gets me excited.
Me too. it'll be at least a fun time for us to just see bucks and be in the woods and be a part of it. Because what we know is that they're gonna disappear about September, right, Hunter?
That's right.
Anyway, guys, thanks so much for being part of this. And remember, this is your element.
Living it.
Hey everybody, listen up. I got mega huge news. Meat Eater Live is heading back out on the road. That's right, join me and the crew. Clay Newcomb, Cal, Yanni, Spencer's gonna be there. Phil the engineer is gonna be there. Meat Eater Live, headed back out. Now, when you get every ticket, okay, every ticket you buy, you get a signed copy of our new Meat Eater Outdoor Cookbook. This tour is celebrating the release of the book. Buy a ticket, get a signed copy, Meat Eater Outdoor Cookbook, wild game recipes for the grill, smoker, camp stove, and campfire, which I'll point out is a $38 value. Here's where we're going to go. April 23rd, the Mesa Arts Center in Mesa, Arizona. April 24th. The Balboa Theater in San Diego. April 25, The Grove in Anaheim, California. April 27, The Crest Theater in Sacramento. April 29, The Union in Salt Lake City. April 30, The Egyptian in Boise. May 1, The Wilma Theater in Missoula. May 2, The Bing Crosby Theater in Spokane, Washington. May 4, Revolution Hall in Portland, Oregon. And May 5, the last day of the tour, Pantages Theater in Tacoma, Washington. For tickets and more information, visit the events page at themeateater.com. Hope to see you at the show.